The World Health Organization says almost 26 million people have been affected by the recent quakes in Turkey and Syria. Russia is calling on NATO to hold an emergency summit over the recent findings about September explosions at the Nord Stream gas pipelines. Former President Jair Bolsonaro is saying that he's planning to return in the coming weeks to Brazil, where he's facing accusations of inciting riots. Good to have you with us. Now, it's been 6 days since a powerful quake hit Turkey and Syria. More than 33,000 people have been confirmed dead, and the death toll is still rising. Officials and medics put the toll in Turkey at more than 24,600 and in Syria above 3,500. The UN aid chief, who's visited Turkey's quake hit area, says the number could double. He says that the earthquake was the worst to hit the region in a century. Tens of thousands of rescue workers are scouring flat neighborhoods despite freezing weather. According to the World Health Organization, almost 26 million people have been affected. Mohamed Ali joined us a short while ago with an update on the relief efforts going on in Syria.
And we know that many countries have been trying to help Syria since this earthquake hit the country. Up till now, more than 60 airplanes coming from over 20 countries have landed in various Syrian airports, loaded with humanitarian aid, on top of which, of course, those countries are Syria's allies and friends like Russia and Iran. Humanitarian aid is being distributed as much as soon as possible by the Syrian government, the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, and even NGOs and ordinary people have been trying to help as much as they can, exerting efforts, whether providing what they can with the food and medicine, or even trying to distribute alongside with the Syrian government and help those affected. However, more help is needed, but unfortunately, there are the sanctions on Syria by the United States and Western countries were not lifted. Nothing was probably offered from them, except for just yesterday, we heard that there were two airplanes coming from Italy that landed in Beirut, loaded with humanitarian aid for Syria. But search operations continue despite the fact that it has been 6 days and hopes are fading for finding anyone alive still over there. But dozens of buildings have collapsed totally, creating this disastrous situation in Syria.
Our correspondent in Istanbul, Rashan Saglam, also joined us and provided us with the latest about the situation in the quake hit areas in Turkey.
It's the sixth day and people are still coming out from under the debris alive. We still have hope, and of course the rescuers still have hope. Just an hour ago, a man was rescued in Gaziantep city, and he is a 60-year-old man. He is handicapped, and he was rescued alive. So this still gives us some hope. Usually after the seventh day, people or the rescuers would stop looking for people or living under the debris. However, it is still working. And when speaking to experts, they said that this is due to the cold weather. Usually when it is in the summer or when the weather is hotter, it is harder for people to survive under the debris. But people are still coming out alive, which gives us a hope. If we want to speak about the logistically, the Hatay airport will be back as per officials to working next Sunday. As we know, the Hatay airport was severely damaged and is out of order now. It's not working. And it is very important for it to work again so that the medical support and any kind of support, nutritional support, can reach the Hatay area, because all the roads leading to Hatay are cut. The medical teams are using the small roads, which is taking them a lot longer to reach that area. So with the airport working again, it will facilitate the work of the aid people and the medical teams better.
The Russian forces are continuing to make headway in the battle for the frontline city of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine. Russia's private military contractors now saying that they have seized a village on the northern edge of the city. The leader of the Wagner group released the video showing its fighters at the entrance to Krasnohora. Ukraine's top military brass saying that Ukraine continues to hold Bakhmut and is trying to stabilize the front line around it. Russia has been trying to capture Bakhmut in the eastern Donbas region for months. The city has turned into a key political and symbolic prize. The Wagner group has been leading the Russian charge in the area. As more evidence emerging about a September explosions at Nord Stream pipelines, Russia calling on NATO to clarify the findings in an emergency session. A recent report by an American investigative journalist said that the U.S. destroyed the pipelines. Now, we've discussed that issue in the latest edition of our News Review program.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Russia calls on NATO to hold an emergency summit over recent findings about September's explosion at the Nord Stream gas pipeline. Foreign Ministry spokesman Maria Zakharova says there is plenty of evidence obtained by journalists on the blasts and the motive behind them. On Wednesday, American investigative journalist Seymour Hersh said U.S. Navy divers destroy the pipelines on orders of President Joe Biden. The White House has dismissed the report as utterly false. Nord Stream pipeline sends gas from Russia to Germany. To discuss that further, we're joined by Greg Simons, researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies, who's joining us from Sweden. Also, we have with us Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author, joining us from London. So, Mr. Papadopoulos, how true do you believe these investigative journalists' reports to be?
Well, first of all, I should say this, that the Kremlin's call for NATO to investigate the act of sabotage against the Nord Stream pipelines will fall on deaf ears. Why? Because America is NATO and NATO is America. If the US one morning was to decide to leave NATO, then by the evening of the same day, the Western military bloc would no longer be in existence. In addition to that, the reason why NATO was established in 1949 was to, in the words of Lord Ismay, the first Secretary General of NATO, to keep the Russians out of Europe, the Americans down in Europe, and the Americans in Europe. So it is not in the interests for the Americans to instruct NATO to investigate the origins of the explosions which rocked the Nord Stream pipelines in 2022. And given the amount of evidence, very persuasive evidence, which has been compiled by independent journalists, it is evidently clear that the Americans have a case to answer for. But alas, NATO will not investigate the matter. Last year, the Russians called upon the United Nations Security Council to investigate the explosions, but the Americans and the British blocked that, which was highly telling and highly suspicious. Perhaps the United Nations General Assembly can discuss the matter. But even if that was to happen, no action would be taken against America because, of course, America is a superpower. The Americans have used NATO to assist them in achieving mastery in Europe, which has enabled the Americans to achieve mastery in the world. So no matter how how much concrete and persuasive evidence emerges indicating American guilt vis-a-vis the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines, nothing will happen against Washington.
Well, nothing may not happen against Washington, but that will definitely adversely affect the relations that Washington has, which is already tense relations with Russia. So how do you believe that can affect the bilateral relations between the two countries? Are we going back to a Cold War status?
Well, relations between America and Russia are absolutely atrocious. Yet, even though the Russians are aware that the Americans committed this act of sabotage against Nord Stream, the Russians understand that this matter will be effectively resolved on the battlefield in Ukraine. That is why the Americans attacked Nord Stream, to try and suffocate the Russian economy. If the Russians emerge victorious in Ukraine, which they will, then what happened to Nord Stream will just be another chapter in the very, very troublesome relationship between America and Russia. But we should also be aware that the attack on Nord Stream was not just an attack on Russia, it was also an attack on Germany.
Germany, exactly.
The Americans have been pressurizing the Germans for many years now to halt their import of Russian natural gas and instead to import American liquefied natural gas. So again, that the Americans attacked Germany is yet another demonstration of how the Americans treat their own allies. Germany on paper is independent and sovereign, but in reality, the Germans are beholden to America.
Okay, so Mr. Simons, in your opinion, as Mr. Papadopoulos brought up this very interesting point that this was not just an attack on Russian pipeline, this was also an attack on Germany because they are the other end of this bargain. So how would that spell the future relations between the U.S. and Germany?
Well, what we've seen clearly during this Ukraine war and under Merkel, Germany was a vassal state of the United States. It had some small leeway of independent action in foreign and security policy. However, what we've seen under Scholz, Germany's become a client state. It has no will of its own. It is just mouthing exactly what Washington is telling it. And, I mean, the Americans are clear about what their interests are. I mean, if we go back to Henry Kissinger, I mean, he laid it out perfectly that this idea of a friend and foe in international relations when he said that the United States has no permanent allies nor permanent enemies. It only has permanent interests. And this is exactly what we're seeing here at a point in time when the United States' unipolar hegemony is in relative decline. So these actions in Ukraine and Europe, and likewise in China with Taiwan, these are attempts by the United States to claw back their hegemony again.
Thank you very much, Mr. Greg Simons, researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies from Sweden, also Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author from London. Thanks to both of you for sharing your thoughts with us.
Brazil's former president Jair Bolsonaro is facing accusations of inciting riots in his country, saying that he will soon go back home from his retreat in the U.S. The far-right politician says he'll be back in Brazil in the coming weeks. Bolsonaro left the country several days before his supporters stormed government buildings in capital Brasilia. They tried to overturn the election victory of his rival, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Bolsonaro is under investigation in Brazil over his alleged role in the January 8th assault. He denies any responsibility, but Lula accuses him of orchestrating what he calls the coup. The U.S. administration has also been under pressure to extradite Bolsonaro. The riots in Brasilia have been compared to the 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol by supporters of former U.S. President Donald Trump. That's a wrap for this news broadcast from Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we will be with you with the explanation of Dua ul-Kumail, the commentary of different parts of this Kumail supplication by the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam. We'll be back after you listen to the parts we're going to discuss.
Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rab, Qawwi ala khidmatika jawarihi, washdud ala al-azimati jawanihi. وهبلي الجد في خشيتك والدوام في الاتصال بخدمتك حتى أسرح إليك في ميادين السابقين
Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we had reached this excerpt of the Divine Kumail supplication. In this part, Imam alayhi salam says, قوي على خدمتك جوارحي. Strengthen my limbs in your service. واشدد على العزيمة جوانحي. Fortify my ribs in determination. وهب لي الجد في خشيتك. Bestow upon me earnestness and in my fear of you and continuity in my being's joint to your service. والدوام في الاتصال بخدمتك. Imam continues, حتى أسرح إليك في ميادين السابقين so that I may move easily towards you in the battlefields of the foremost وأسرع إليك في البارزين hurry to you among the prominent وأشتاق إلى قربك في المشتاقين so that I desire fervently your proximity among the fervently desirous وأدنو منك دنو المخلصين so that I will move near to you with the nearness of the sincere, fear you with the fear of those who have conviction, أخافك مخافة الموقنين, and gather with the believers in your nearness, وأجتمع في جوارك مع المؤمنين. This accompanying the believers in the nearness of the Almighty Allah in hereafter is something the prerequisites and the conditions of which must be met in this world. There are some prerequisites for these special blessings of the Almighty Allah. And as you were previously with us, we mentioned some of them in the previous episodes, like avoiding the company of people of weak faith, like avoiding eating doubtful meals, and purifying the soul from vices. Also, we mentioned gluttony. Now, the last of these things we are going to mention is avoiding too much sleep. This is something that brings about dullness in worship and the death of humane spirit. This is something that we will look at in the light of the traditions after a short break.
My limbs for your service and sustain the strength of my hands to preserve in your service and bestow upon me the eagerness to fear you and constantly serve you so that I may lead myself towards you in the field with the vanguards who are in the fore rank and be swift towards you amongst those who hasten towards you and urge eagerly to be near you and draw myself towards you like those who sincerely draw themselves towards you and to fear you like the fear of those who believe firmly in you and that I may join the congregation of the faithful congregated near you.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. Feeling the peace all around, seeing things we can never imagine, hearing the sound of rivers flow, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
It is narrated about excessive sleep from Imam Baqir alayhi salam that Prophet Moses ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi salam said to Allah, "Which of your servants do you show more enmity to?" The Almighty answered him, "Jifatun bil layl battalun bin nahar." The one who is in bed like a dead person all night and spends his day uselessly. The Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam also has stated that Solomon's mother told him, "Iyyaka wa kathrata an-nawmi bil-layl." Do not sleep much at nights. "Tad'u ar-rajula faqiran yawm al-qiyamah." Because it causes man to be resurrected in the hereafter barehanded. And Imam Ali alayhi salam has stated, "بِئِسَ الْغَرِيمُ النَّوْمُ." Sleeping is a bad enemy. "يُفْنِي قَصِيرَ الْعُمُرُ." It wastes the short life. "وَيُفَوِّتُ كَثِيرَ الْأَجْرِ." And eliminates great reward. So, by avoiding what Islam has forbidden, like unlawful food, vices, gluttony, and excessive sleep, one's limbs are granted the power to serve Allah. قَوِّ عَلَىٰ خِدْمَتِكَ جَوَارِحِ. It is by this strength that the eyes would not see but the truth and whatever Allah desires. The ears would hear nothing but the speech of the Almighty Allah. This is the heart of obedience. The hands would not perform but honest attempts. The stomach would not eat but lawful food. The lust would not be used but in lawful ways. And the feet would not go to anywhere but towards divine gatherings, divine mosques, places, holy shrines. In short, all human limbs, as well as his soul, move in the direction of worshipping Allah. حَتَّى أَسْرَحَ إِلَيْكَ فِي مَيَادِينِ السَّابِقِينَ and serving his servants. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Realities on the streets. Part 2. The Aryan Empire. The Great Civilization. The military superpower in the Middle East, the king of the kings in Iran. These are the phrases that many media in the world use to describe Iran with. Modern cities with towering high-rises, many glamorous ceremonies, happy faces, and a thriving economy. But the world knew a face of Iran that was different from the realities on the streets. Former Prime Minister Amir Hossein Hoveyda has said about the 50s, people's economic condition was getting worse every day. Even the oil revenues were wasted because of corruption. Despite people's pathetic economic condition, the Shah's condition was getting better. After efforts by former Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in 1951, Iran's oil industry was nationalized and it sent money to the Iranian government's coffers. Unemployment among the migrants was rampant. Those who were lucky were hired in workshops, and some of them became seasonal workers or chose to become retailers with a meager capital. But most of them were unemployed or even worse than that, ill and unable to work. The Shah was talking about efforts to improve the situation, but in practice, something else happened. Now the franchises of some of the most well-known factories, the best hotels and restaurants made the dream city. Thanks to the media, the tourist attractions lure travelers from all across the world to the Achaemenid civilization. What they saw was a country that was fast developing, and after a while, it would be on the list of developed countries. The upper echelons of society enjoyed the best facilities that money could buy. The Shah had counted on the aristocrats and the rich people for establishing factories and conducting business with other countries. They were mostly influential people who owned land. They had received huge sums of money as damages for land reforms. They had invested their capital in industries, importing foodstuff and luxury items. On the other hand, the Shah did all he could to attract foreign investors and gave them incentives like tax exemptions. The result of the government's decision was to set up industries that were reliant on raw materials that were imported, and what's more, he brought many foreign experts to Iran instead of transferring the knowledge in advanced industries. So knowledge and technology did not enter Iran. It was only the Iranian workers who worked for them for the lowest wages. The factories mushroomed everywhere, and the rural migrants had no other option but to work there. Iran's non-oil exports shrank every year. In 1977, Iran's non-oil exports comprised only 2%, and oil exports comprised 98% of the total exports. On the other hand, Iranian businessmen had gone on an importing spree to the extent that 10 years after the land reforms had been introduced, Iran, which was almost self-sufficient in agricultural products, turned into a major importer of foodstuffs. They imported everything they needed at the lowest prices. The few farmers who produced agri-products could not compete with them. The fertile lands became barren, and agriculture in Iran was ruined. The government was disappointed with agriculture as a source of revenue. It decided to push the industries with foreign investment. Industries did not help the workers and did not reduce poverty, but rather increased the capital of domestic and mostly foreign investors. From 1976, the oil revenues diminished, but the Shah had counted on the large sums of money and by relying on that had launched big budget industries with foreign investment and imports. The price of imported goods skyrocketed because of the developments and the inflation surged. The costs of housing and food went through the roof. Life became harder than before for the working and downtrodden classes. Unemployment and consequently, the yawning social gap put more pressure on the weak. William Sullivan, the U.S. ambassador in Iran, described the economic situation as the highest inflation, the failed plan to provide people with affordable housing, and the catastrophic living condition in Tehran. According to the statistics, the unfair distribution of wealth was getting worse by the year. In the final years, only 45 families were in control of about 85% of the companies in the country. The gap was completely tangible for the people. The aristocrats' lifestyle was completely different from the way ordinary people on the streets lived, and everyone knew it. During the final years of the Pahlavi rule, many of the general indices of welfare were awful. The level of the general hygiene was so low that 174 out of 1,000 children would die before the age of 5. The figure was 1.5 times more than neighboring Turkey in the same year. Life expectancy among men was 55 years old and among women, 57. Out of the 31 million people in Iran in 1972, 16 million people suffered from malnutrition, 4 million of whom were in severe condition. Housing was in the worst possible condition. 1 million of the 5 million Iranian households used to live in a room or a tent. According to the last census in the Pahlavi era in 1976, 53% of the people were illiterate. In the same year, the figure was 33% for Turkey, 44% for Syria, and 40% for Libya. The economic crisis during the last two decades of the Pahlavi rule can be considered one of the main reasons behind the collapse of the monarchy that was armed to the teeth. Some people didn't predict a full-blown revolution until the final months. It was during the cold winter days when a man came to Iran. The underprivileged saw a new era on the horizon for the country. Now we know what the people in Iran saw and went through, but people in other parts of the world weren't aware of. The world media showed images of the glamour and glory of Iran, but they were different from the realities on the ground and on the streets. It took millions of people to the streets to welcome a man so that Iran can take a step into the new world.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
اون چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
February 1st, 1979. Imam Khomeini's historic speech outlining the state of affairs of the course of the revolution. You have gained victory through your exceptional efforts in unity of expression. Of course, as the first step, your victory is now in the initial stage, in as much as you have swept aside from the scene the main traitor named Mohammad Reza, although it is said that he is making frantic effort abroad. Even now that his own masters have cerned him and are not allowing him entry, he is seeking help from some of his likes in order to find a way out of his predicament. But he is thinking in vain to be able to hold the reins of power once again after this dynasty's 50 years of treachery and after 30 or so years of crimes and treason committed by these treacherous men against this country, pushing it backward. yes, transformed our country's culture into a culture of colonialism.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. This is Ali, and we are trying to present some of the sayings of the late Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi, on the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi, in a saying says that the final victory is when Islam, in all dimensions, and its rulings, is being established in Iran. And the greater victory is that Islam rulings in all regions of the world. And the greater victory is that when Islamic rulings in all regions of the world is going to be implemented. Islam is the source of human happiness. We have been saying that the revolution that had happened in Iran in 1979 had three major factors. One was the leadership of Ayatollah Khomeini, that played a key role with charisma and specific characteristics of the late Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi, was very influential in the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The second was the nation themselves, the people, who backed him, who backed the leadership. But what is the turning point, what is the main factor that connects these two, is the third factor, which is the religion and beliefs of the people, Islam.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi.
Islamic rulings were something that people raced for, and Imam rahmatullah alayhi says that the final victory is the time that, inshallah, indirectly and implicitly, he says that the time that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam comes and he's going to implement Islamic rulings over the scene of the earth, and all the humanity will benefit from Islamic rulings, and Islam by itself has come for the prosperity and happiness of the mankind. The final victory is then that Islam is going to be widespread in the world. So still we are saying, and we are looking at three factors that caused the Islamic Republic to happen. That is the factors of the victory, one of which was Islam and Islamic beliefs. That Imam hopes that, inshallah, in future, when it is going to get connected to the final government of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, Islam would be widespread in the whole world, and it will show its effects and fruits to the whole mankind. We wish that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give us the tawfiq to understand that time when Islamic rulings are being implemented in the whole world.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the limelight.
The Saudi kingdom continues to oppress and harass its citizens amid international silence and the support of Western countries. Many international human rights organizations have expressed concern that a loophole in Saudi Arabia's laws allows the country's judges to continue issuing the death penalty to innocent people for minor charges. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. website, Saudi Leaks, has covered this story and tells us more. Human Rights Watch listed Saudi Arabia among the 10 most prominent human rights violators worldwide in 2022. The organization highlighted the mass execution of 81 men in Saudi Arabia, which ranked second in the top 10 human rights violators worldwide. The organization indicated that on March 12, 2022, the Saudi authorities executed 81 men, their largest mass execution in years, despite recent promises to limit the use of the death penalty. And with the largest execution massacre in Saudi Arabia's history and record sentences close to a century, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman tightened his grip on the country in 2022, more than ever before, granting himself tyrannical powers. Mohammed bin Salman appointed himself Prime Minister, shielded by interests and diplomacy from any prosecution, and with free hand in heinous human rights violations. As an inevitable result of Crown Prince's cruelty, the intensity of repression in Saudi Arabia increased in 2022 to carry out the largest mass execution, and dozens await their fate in death rows, including minors and individuals who did not face serious charges. Human rights defenders, on the other hand, activists, scholars, academics and bloggers, and dissidents are in detention centres. Women are being prosecuted. Freedom of opinion and freedom of expression is being violated, and people are being displaced from their lands and homes. With the onset of 2022 and the impact of the energy crisis, global political fluctuations and the Russia-Ukraine war, the diplomatic embargo on Saudi Arabia was broken. After a visit by the French President Emmanuel Macron at the end of 2021, Mohammed bin Salman inaugurated the season of diplomatic visits that had been prohibited since the brutal killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi embassy in Istanbul, Turkey, and a hierarchy of human rights file was lost between the energy and economic files. In March of 2022, Mohammed bin Salman received British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. US President Joe Biden was received in July, and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz was received in September. These visits constitute the tip of the iceberg of normalization countries have made with Saudi Arabia's violations. In parallel with breaking the isolation, Saudi Arabia carried out, in March of last year, the largest mass execution in the country's history, followed by grave violations including arbitrary sentences of up to 90 years in prison against activists, not for great crimes, but just for making tweets. Really, for making tweets. The Tasnim News Agency has also covered the same story. A non-governmental organization recently warned a new mass execution could happen in Saudi Arabia anytime soon, slamming massive violations of human rights in the kingdom. The Committee for Defense of Human Rights in the Arabian Peninsula said in a statement that the so-called Specialized Criminal Court in the capital Riyadh has sentenced several more Saudi nationals to death, simply for the sake of expressing their opinions on social media platforms, or participating in peaceful pro-democracy rallies, or denouncing social discrimination in Saudi Arabia. The Beirut-based human rights organization went on to highlight that the issuance of such arbitrary rulings on numerous occasions proves the hollow nature of the House of Saud's claim about respect for human rights. The Committee for the Defense of Human Rights in the Arabian Peninsula said, "Saudi Arabia is the kingdom of terror," and called on the international community and human rights institutions around the world to stop the looming mass executions in Saudi Arabia, which could take place under false accusations and not be based on legal criteria. It also identified some of those who have been handed down death sentences. These individuals include Yusuf al-Mansaf, Abdul-Majid al-Namr, Javad Qariris, Muhammad al-Faraj, Hassan Zaki al-Faraj and Ali Hassan al-Subaiti. Since Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler in 2017, the kingdom has arrested hundreds of activists, hundreds of bloggers, intellectuals and others for their political activism, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnation. Muslim scholars have been executed and women's rights campaigners have also been put behind bars and tortured as freedom of expression, freedom of association and belief continue to be denied by the kingdom's legal authorities. Over the past years, Riyadh has also redefined its anti-terrorism laws to target activism and dissent. The Conversation website has also covered the same story and tells us more. Saudi Arabia recently sentenced Noura bint Saeed al-Qahtani to 45 years in prison after she had expressed her views on social media sites. This comes just a couple of weeks after a Leeds University student, Salma al-Shahab, was sentenced to 34 years in prison for using Twitter to retweet views of activists who are critical of the country. There had been a few small signs that Saudi Arabia had been offering its women a few more freedoms in the past few years, but recent harsh prison sentences against women activists have sparked increased debate about the country's human rights abuses. Despite these cases, Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman was invited to Queen Elizabeth II's funeral, although in the end, a government minister attended in his place. The fiancé of murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi, Hatice Cengiz, criticised the invitation of Mohammed bin Salman and its implications that the United Kingdom and the international community were turning a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's excesses. One factor that means that the West is less likely to criticise Saudi Arabia right now is the war in Ukraine. However, the imprisonment of these two women is just an intensification of long-term oppression of women in Saudi Arabia by the regime, while the West looks the other way. The Trump administration avoided the issue, refraining from criticizing Saudi Arabia's human rights record. Donald Trump made Saudi Arabia part of his first foreign trip and further affirmed the US's long-standing policy of keeping a close partnership with Saudi Arabia. The Obama administration was more critical and raised some concerns over human rights in Saudi Arabia, though it still maintained a stable working relationship with the Saudis. Britain, as another key global actor, has more or less followed the same trajectory as the United States. It cooperates with Saudi Arabia on a variety of matters, politically, militarily, economically, and even selling Saudi Arabia arms that the latter then has used to indiscriminately kill people in Yemen. Saudi Arabia has had one of the poorest human rights records in the world for decades. Some would argue that the West has been letting Saudi Arabia get away with it with human rights violations for many years.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.